This is a podcast from margaretthatcher.org.
Margaret Thatcher's Memoir of the Falklands War, Episode 1. Notes on the Emergency Cabinet Committee. I set this up following the advice of Harold Macmillan, who soon after the weekend of the invasion came to see me to offer his support as the senior Prime Minister. Alec Douglas-Hume had been going to come with him, but was unable to do so because of the recurrence of his old back trouble. Harold Macmillan advised strongly that a small emergency committee be set up for the conduct of the Falklands campaign, and that if necessary, a separate economic committee should be convened. He said it would be fatal to mix the two. He also asked if we had reinforced Gibraltar, made arrangements for wounded ships, and suggested South Africa may be approached if necessary, and asked about Argentina and nuclear weapons. I decided to keep the economics of the campaign completely separate. The emergency committee therefore consisted of the Home Secretary, Willie Whitelaw, the Foreign Secretary, Francis Pym, Defence Secretary, John Knott, and Chancellor of the Duchy, Cecil Parkinson, as well as myself. The Chief of Defence Staff, Terry Lewin, and the Permanent Secretary of the Foreign Office, Sir Anthony Ackland, attended regularly. Within a few meetings, it became necessary for the Attorney General, Sir Michael Havers, to join, as we constantly had to consider what actions came within the inherent right of self-defence and Article 51 of the United Nations Charter. Realising that the longer-term problems of the Falklands required someone whole-time, I asked Sir Michael Palliser, recently retired head of the Foreign Office, if he would undertake the task, which he did, and he regularly attended the meetings too. In practice, his contributions and expertise were constantly applied to the diplomatic side of our work, especially in advising on contacts, consultations, and information with other countries. Sir Robert Armstrong headed the Secretariat, and absolutely outstanding for his far-sighted ingenuity and diligence was Robert Wade Geary, who regretfully left before our work was finally complete because he had been appointed High Commissioner in Delhi. The terms of reference of this Subcommittee of the Overseas and Defence Policy Committee, called Subcommittee on the South Atlantic and the Falkland Islands, or ODSA for short, were: to keep under review political and military developments relating to the South Atlantic and the Falklands, and to report as necessary to OD. It was set up formally on the Tuesday following the invasion the previous Friday. The agenda usually consisted of: first, all military matters. That is, 1. Report on last 24 hours. 2. Immediate decisions. 3. Longer-term matters to be put in hand. 2. Diplomatic matters, which were, of course, particularly important while the task force was in passage to the Falklands and the several sets of negotiations were in progress. And towards the end, 3. Preparations for the post-invasion period and the longer term. By the time of our first meeting, 7th of April, the task force had already been dispatched with a speed and efficiency which astounded the world and made us feel very proud and very British. The decision had been taken by Cabinet on the evening of the day of the invasion, Friday. The main carrier force and accompanying ships left port on Monday, 5th of April, fully and properly equipped. Also, we had secured the passage of the famous Security Council Resolution 502 through the superlative performance of our representative at the United Nations, Sir Anthony Parsons. It was superlative throughout the entire campaign, and the unremitting diplomatic effort of the FO. Alas, by the time of our first meeting, Peter Carrington had resigned at his own insistence, in spite of Herculean efforts on the part of Willie Whitelaw and myself to persuade him to stay. John Knott had offered his resignation, which I could not possibly accept when the task force was on the ocean. Thank goodness I didn't accept it. John was splendid throughout the campaign. Our first meeting was taken up with 1. A message from Al Haig that he wanted to come to London that day, but we had a debate in the House and couldn't receive him. He agreed to come the following day, Maundy Thursday. We made it clear that he was coming as a friend and not as a mediator. 2. We discussed the recent military steps, especially as our nuclear submarines, SSNs, were due in the area within the next few days. We were not able to decide immediately on whether to set up a 200-mile exclusion zone for ships round the Falklands because of arguments about the effect on Hague, etc., but agreed to meet at about 7 p.m. that same evening in my room at the House to decide whether the Defence Secretary, in winding up the debate, should announce such a zone. Unusually for him, John had had an extremely difficult time winding up the previous Saturday, and it was vital for his own confidence that he should do well that day. We had extended the debate for an hour to end at 11 p.m, which gave us a little more time. We were uncertain about whether to fly the governor to Ascension to put him aboard the task force. Some argued that it would boost the confidence of the Falkland Islanders, who we realised must be in a state of despair. On balance, we felt it would look gimmicky and that he could probably be of more help to us at home. I had seen the governor, Rex Hunt, and the two marine commanders on their return. I had spoken to him on Saturday when he landed in Montevideo, the first time we knew for sure the time and pattern of the invasion. When he and the two marines saw me in Number 10, I asked him, "Were you aware that an invasion was in the offing?" And he replied, "No, I thought it was just another alarm of the kind we had had previously." He told me that when he had received our message on the previous Wednesday, he had contacted one of the Argentine representatives, I believe of the airline, on the island, who assured him that as far as he knew, nothing was afoot. Alas, in retrospect, it appears that there were a number of other Argentinians who had been reporting on every movement of our Marines. One of the Marine commanders sketched out the shape of the operation, which he said had been very well planned, with the first wave of troops coming from the landward side. They would not come out and fight, but waited until overwhelming armour and force had arrived. Then, he told me, the local Argentine commander knew almost every one of the names of the reinforcement Marines who had been there only 4 days. Our two commanders were very anxious to go back. One of them was very familiar with the terrain, having been on a tour of duty for several months. They were soon flown to Ascension and joined the main force. It was they who finally took the surrender at Government House when Port Stanley fell. The governor was in fact a great help to us in London, frequently broadcasting on BBC external services to the Falklands, assuring them his bags were packed to return as soon as he could. The media commentators were constantly questioning him about whether he really expected to return, and he never faltered. He retorted that I had said in the House that our objective was the restoration of British sovereignty and the return of British administration, and he was sure that was what I meant. There were, of course, to be many times in the coming negotiations when we wondered whether we should be able to secure the return of Rex Hunt. But to return to 7th of April. We soon heard that Al Haig would come on Easter Thursday, and we met accordingly at 7 p.m. that evening. We had a long argument. Francis was absolutely against announcing a maritime exclusion zone that evening. He thought it would upset Haig coming the next day, and we could wait longer before deciding. John Knott fought strongly for the zone, and eventually, through patient persistence, the rest of us managed to overcome Francis's objections. It was a pattern to be repeated many times. The decision was the right one. John did a superb winding-up speech announcing the establishment of the zone. Not a voice was raised against it, and Jim Callaghan was heard to say, "Absolutely right." And so the zone took effect from midnight, 11th-12th April. That is, came into effect in the early hours of Easter Monday morning. It is worth noting that at no time during the Falklands operation did we say we would take action until we were in a position to do it. By the time the MEZ commenced, an SSN was there, and others arriving very shortly indeed. I was determined that we should never put ourselves in a position where bluff could be called, and we never did. Haig was also informed of the zone a little in advance of the announcement. When I met him the next day, he said it was an absolutely right decision. Third meeting. We met briefly before Haig arrived and approved the rules of engagement for the SSNs in the Maritime Exclusion Zone, the first time for most of us there. Many more ROEs were to follow, and we learned the importance of approving them on time. That is, before any possible embarrassing occasion could arise, and of getting them right. We discussed how to handle the Haig talks. But my mind and decisions were totally committed. Argentina must withdraw. British administration must be restored. I'm afraid the firmness of this approach came as something of a shock to Al Haig and his advisers, who included General Walters, Mr. Enders and Ed Strater from the US Embassy in London. The ambassador was away. It soon became clear that mediation was his purpose, but at least he came to see us first to be clear about our position before going to Buenos Aires. Again and again we stressed, all Argentine forces out, British administration restored. By this time we had realised that British sovereignty at law had not been changed by the fact of invasion, then we would negotiate with Argentina on the basis that the islanders' wishes were paramount. Al Haig really wanted to issue an agreed statement before he left, recognising that there may have to be an intermediate phase between Argentine withdrawal and the restoration of British sovereignty, but I was not prepared to do so. As he left, General Walters said to me that, "You certainly live up to your name as the Iron Lady." It hadn't really occurred to me to look at it that way. To me, the position was clear-cut, and that was that. I had previously asked General Walters whether going back over their intelligence there had been any signs of an impending invasion. Knowing that the information we had put together from our intelligence on the Wednesday before the invasion had come as a shock to Haig when Nico Henderson told him as a matter of urgency. But the fact is that the US were no more aware than we were, and they had their eyes on Central America rather more than South America. As he faced the TV cameras when he left, Al Haig was absolutely fair. I always found he was fair throughout the whole negotiations. Tough, indeed a very tough negotiator, but fair in his dealings with us and with the press. When we disagreed with any part of a statement he wanted to make, he would take it out. He took off for Buenos Aires. The task force continued, and the military planning proceeded apace and with enthusiasm and concentration. None of us knew whether it would need to be used, but we thought that the nearer the task force got, the more chance there may be that the Argentines would withdraw. I confess that from the outset I never really believed that a military government could withdraw. The scenes in the square in Buenos Aires, balcony scenes to the crowd below, massed and chanting, were of such jubilation that I couldn't see the junta pulling out unless they were granted sovereignty on the price of withdrawal. This I had spent patient hours explaining to Haig that they couldn't have. I remember asking him whether, if a burglar had taken all his possessions, he would consider that he had to negotiate with the burglar as to how much he was entitled to keep. I'm afraid that Al had a very difficult time in Buenos Aires. Again, crowds were chanting in the main square, although General Walters told me afterwards that the crowd stopped abruptly at the exits from the square. It was difficult for our American friends to know with whom they were negotiating. First Galtieri, then the rest of the junta, then the military, 50 or so, behind the junta. Over that Easter weekend, Michael Foote officially asked for the recall of Parliament to report on Haig's visit. His talks in Buenos Aires took much longer than expected. Eventually, our own group met again at No. 10 on Sunday evening because there were some decisions that we had to take over the task force. We agreed that Parliament should be recalled on the Wednesday, which would give time should anything come out of Haig's visit to Buenos Aires. We reviewed the position and response from other countries. The old Commonwealth, especially Rob Muldoon and also Malcolm Fraser, were magnificent. The EEC had come up trumps with President Mitterrand, who was staunch throughout, and Helmut Schmidt, who was also firm, in the lead. All had agreed to take positive action on armament suspension and to stop imports from the Argentine. We decided that Francis and I, together with John, would meet Al Haig on Monday morning to resume talks. When we had heard what he had to say, we would adjourn and call in Willie and Cecil for consultation. Thus began in earnest the long series of negotiations. When we had been discussing in Cabinet whether to send the task force, or rather the pros and cons, for there was never much doubt that it would have to go, we had been very worried about the time it would take to get there and how we should deal with public opinion in the intervening period. We knew that the Argentines would probably pile men and materiel into the islands, which they did, and we weren't quite sure how we were going to occupy opinion at home. We needn't have worried about that particular matter. Ships were constantly being chartered, and there was a shuttle service of negotiations which kept the media very busy. We had also decided to put defence correspondents on the ships, and they reported during the long journey. Never shall I forget that first round. Again, General Walters and Enders were with Haig. He began by giving an oral account of some proposals he was putting forward, and which we understood had been discussed in Buenos Aires, and which could secure agreement to withdraw. There were several general points, and I made a careful note. 1. On basis 502, we and Argentine agree to follow steps which should be seen altogether. 2. All security forces to be withdrawn from islands and zones within 2 weeks. 3. No further forces to be introduced. The withdrawn forces would go back to normal operating areas. 4. There should be a commission in place of the governor, consisting of one UK, one US, one Argentine, who would act together, whether by unanimity or majority was not specified, but their first duty was to supervise withdrawal. For that purpose, they would need each to have observers. Each member of the commission could fly his flag at headquarters. 5. The traditional local administrators, that is, executive and legislative councils, would continue, but each would have one Argentine representative added to them. 6. Travel and trade and communications would be promoted by the commission, but they could only act by making recommendations to the UK and Argentine representatives, who would both have to agree before anything could be done. 7. The interim period would end hopefully by end December, and negotiations about the status of the islands would be conducted during that time. We adjourned and went into our larger committee. These general proposals were full of holes about which we would have to negotiate hard, but they were presented in such a way that it looked as if there was a possibility that we could get the Argentine forces off by giving only A. a commission of which we constituted a third in place of a governor, and a commission that looked pretty powerless except to achieve withdrawal. B. one Argentine representative on each council, and we would have to ensure that he had been resident on the islands, both of them, and was not someone from Argentina nominated by the junta. And C. an Argentine flag flown alongside others at headquarters. There was obviously a lot more to it, because 1. There was no security for the islanders after the interim period. The US would have to be asked to secure the islands from renewed invasion. 2. We were concerned that we, the aggrieved party, seemed to have no right to defend our own people. Even worse, what did deploying to normal areas mean? Surely we could now say that the South Atlantic was a normal area. We must have the right to be at least as close to the Falklands as the Argentine forces. 3. There was nothing to make it clear that the islanders' wishes were paramount in the final negotiations. 4. There must be no possibility of steadily putting more and more Argentines onto the island during the interim period, so that by some kind of osmosis they would soon be in the majority, and our people would then probably leave. We went back for further discussions, and it was soon clear that we had not got the full story. 1. Galtieri wanted the task force to turn back the moment an agreement was signed. We argued for nearly 2 hours on the point alone, until I said I just wasn't prepared to accept it. The task force would continue. If an agreement were signed, it would not enter the exclusion zones, which were defined as 150 nautical miles round Falklands, South Georgia, South Sandwich. Note, we regretted afterwards that we had ever put South Georgia into the first proposals. But at the time, there was a possibility of getting the Argentines off without a battle. 2. The Argentines, starting from the Communications Agreement of 1971, wanted Argentines to have the same rights to residence, property, business, etc. as the Falkland Islanders. They wanted the Commission positively to promote that and to decide it. We fought that one down on the grounds that the period of the administration must not change the nature of the life on the islands. The laws and administration there before must continue. 3. The Argentines wanted several UN Assembly resolutions mentioned by name, and that negotiations on the long-term future were to be concluded in the spirit of those texts. They were all resolutions, the gist of which was that Argentina had title to the islands, and that it was time Western colonization was ended. No mention of self-determination. We looked carefully at the resolutions and at the charter. The battle on self-determination is between those who believe that interests can be paramount, in which case governments can decide what is in the best interests of the people, and those who say that the people's expressed wishes are the proper guide to these interests and the proper yardstick for self-determination. We argued through the evening until quite late into the night, but finally came to a compromise that we would pursue further negotiations on a somewhat woolly text, but there were some conditions which were crystal clear. The withdrawal zones, that one Argentine per council must be local, and that they must have the same qualifying period for voting rights as the Falklanders. We were to meet again the following morning. The American team had had a direct secure line from Number 10 to the White House, and had pursued their own inquiries while we were adjourned. It is possible that they had been in touch with Buenos Aires, but we do not know. So ended Easter Monday. By the following morning, events had moved further. Late the previous night, our time, Haig had received a message from Buenos Aires. Apparently, as he left Buenos Aires to return to London, Costa Mendes had thrust a document with five demands on it into Haig's hand, saying they were his, Costa Mendes's, 5 points which were essential. During the night of Easter Monday, a message was received that the five demands were absolute. I cannot remember them all, but the main features were 1. Sovereignty must belong to the Argentines. 2. The Argentine governor must stay. 3. The Argentine flag must be flown, etc. I need go no further. It seemed as if our previous day had been wasted, and yet wasn't this really what we expected of a junta? The condition for withdrawal was that they leave the spoils of invasion. Al Haig and General Walters and Mr. Enders were very depressed and began to work on Buenos Aires. Later in the day, he reported that the junta was not now persisting with the 5 points, but were being difficult about the terms of reference for the negotiations on the final status. We, of course, persisted with the paramountcy of the islanders' wishes and pointed out that we were working for the restoration of British administration. We decided to prepare our draft of the relevant paragraph about what would be acceptable to us. We realised that we could go no further. Indeed, some of us were worried that we had already gone too far in even considering the Special Commission the withdrawal, or agreement that we would not enter the exclusion zones if the Argentines withdrew. We knew that we must get a guarantee of the islanders' security from the US. But if the Argentines would totally withdraw and could be prevented from returning, weren't these concessions worth making? Having decided to return to Washington and not Buenos Aires, he asked us not to reveal the details of the discussions. Quite right. One can't negotiate in public successfully. We had to report to Parliament the following day. Parliament was understanding that day, and in other debates, that we couldn't reveal the details of the negotiations. Shortly after the opening speeches, Mr. Haig was on the telephone. He had been having trouble from Buenos Aires that the US was not being even-handed, as between Argentina and Britain. He was going to have to make a statement if he was ever to be able to return to Buenos Aires to continue the negotiations. Problems arose over the use of Ascension Island. We were having to put an enormous amount of equipment, planes and ships through there, which required extra staff, stores and fuel. In practice, the US was being splendidly helpful, but Buenos Aires was complaining, and it was suggested that the statement would include a passage to the effect that only normal facilities were being permitted. This would have made life impossible for us, and I had to insist that although the base was American, the islands were British sovereign territory, and we must use them as much as we wish. Fortunately, Al Haig was very cooperative, and the matter of Ascension was not mentioned in the statement. The committee met again on Easter Thursday morning, not in No. 10, but in the Ministry of Defence. We had to send more troops to join the task force, to agree the new draft about the vexed interim period, and to agree a message to the US, stressing the need for the US to play an important role in enforcing the agreement during the interim period, and ensuring that after it terminated, the Argentinians did not attempt another invasion. I'm afraid we never got very far in involving the Americans in either of these ways. We had met at MOD so that the whole committee could have a thorough military briefing. It was important that we knew precisely the forces ranged against us, their capability, the effects of the Antarctic winter, and the options available. At the time, many people had the idea that if the negotiations were not successful, the task force could blockade the Falklands and mount several commando-type raids. Anyone who had harboured such ideas was soon disabused of them. Quite apart from the losses of aircraft which could be expected, and the two aircraft carriers only had 20 Harriers, the difficulties of maintaining them in stormy seas were enormous. It was clear that we had a period of 2 to 3 weeks in May during which we should have to land, if such a landing were feasible without terrible casualties. We were faced almost immediately with problems of how much more equipment, troops and aircraft to send, how to deal with POWs, what to do about South Georgia and when. There was to be no respite at all. Decisions must be made quickly. I looked from the chiefs of staff to the committee. It was a lot for them to take, and I realised they were somewhat stunned, except, of course, the Secretary of State for Defence, who was already aware. By this time, the press had got to know we were all at MOD. I remember saying that everyone must look confident as they left, and we would start to take the requisite decisions the following day. The MOD were magnificent at planning the logistics. Requests for more merchant ships, rules of engagement, more troops came through thick and fast. Sometimes I realise that we can take things a day at a time, which would be impossible if they all came at us at once. So it was to be with the Falklands. The initial task force seemed big, but a veritable armada was to follow. Our main task on the Friday was to consider and approve the rules of engagement for transit, for within the 200-mile zone around South Georgia, and for repossession of South Georgia. It was the first time any of us had had the awesome responsibility of ensuring that our armed forces had the right instructions, that they were clear, and that we had covered all possible eventualities. At no time must they ever be in difficulty because of our lack of foresight. We questioned the chiefs of staff carefully, and after a long discussion and close examination, we approved them. Many others were to follow as each new phase of the operation had to be considered. We had other things to consider. Vulcan bombers had been converted to in-flight refueling, and one of the newspapers had found out. Would they run a scare story that we could therefore reach the Argentinian mainland, which we had no intention of doing? We decided there was nothing we could do to prevent any such report. I had also received a report from President Reagan saying that Galtieri was anxious to avoid conflict. There was no difficulty in replying to that one. Al Haig had the unenviable task of returning to Buenos Aires with our modified proposals. He was having a very difficult time with the junta. I was at Checkers over the weekend and had to return to No. 10 on Saturday evening to receive a telephone call from President Reagan. For some reason, the direct telephone line was not working well to Checkers. Buenos Aires apparently was wanting further concessions from us, even though they were the aggressors. I said we could go no further, and President Reagan agreed that it would not be reasonable to ask us to move further. On Monday, we wanted to know exactly where things stood on the negotiations and what was the text then being discussed in Buenos Aires. Later that day, further details arrived. They did not meet our requirements, especially on the paramountcy of the wishes of the islanders. It was clear that Argentina was trying to keep what she had taken by force. We agreed with Haig that he should go to Washington from Buenos Aires and not come on to London. We would let him have a detailed commentary on his latest proposals. We also authorised the operation to repossess South Georgia. As events happened, this was to take longer to start than we anticipated because the ships arrived in a force 11 gale which lasted for several days. The following day, having received a message from Haig, we agreed that Francis Pym should go to Washington with our counterproposals to Haig's latest BA proposals. They were dreadful. Even Haig admitted that they were a significant step backwards from the London text in each of the areas of greatest importance, the long-term negotiations, the interim administration and withdrawal. Our fleet was to stand off at 1,750 nautical miles and within 15 days was to redeploy to usual operating bases or areas. The arrangements for interim administration would have given the Argentinians two reps on each council. Residence, ownership, disposition of property should all be promoted and facilitated between the islands and Argentina. There would be proposals for compensation of islanders who did not wish to remain, etc. It was, of course, a complete takeover within the interim period. And having got the British forces out of the way, the Argentinians could have returned at any time. Al Haig was not going to publish the text, but merely say he had finished that phase of his efforts. We agreed that Francis, in his discussions, should be guided by our counter-proposals and should request an American guarantee on the security of the islands. On Saturday the 24th of April, Francis returned from Washington. This was to be one of the most crucial days in the Falkland story, and a critical one for me personally. Margaret Thatcher's Memoir of the Falklands War continues with Episode 2 of this podcast.